Play to Potential Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the 14th conversation at the Play to Potential Podcast series. I'm Deepak Jayaraman, the creator and curator of this series of conversations. I'm an executive coach and do work in the space of leadership development, but with a focus on leadership transitions, both in the context of companies and careers. My objective from this podcast is to have learning conversations with a range of leaders and share those curated insights with you. And the topics in the podcast range across leadership, transitions, and careers. This time I'm excited to be talking to Dr. Pramath Sinha. Pramath has a BTech from IIT Kanpur and a PhD from UPenn. He subsequently joined McKinsey and was with them for about 13 years. He was the founding dean at the Indian School of Business, ISB, in Hyderabad, where he's now a board member. He's subsequently been instrumental in setting up Ashoka University, a liberal arts university that aims to be at par with the best in the world, and Vedika Scholars Program for Women, a unique alternative to MBA to prepare women leaders for the future. Today, his portfolio of work includes helping people set up institutions of excellence, includes consulting work with the Albright Stonebridge Group, and some board positions. In our conversation, we spoke about a range of topics, including his thoughts on a career in consulting, transitioning out of consulting and the pitfalls there, entrepreneurship, how he thinks about leadership of the future and the link with education, and much, much more. Without further ado, over to the conversation. Pramath, thank you for your time. Excited to be talking to you at this wonderful ISB Mohali campus. Thanks for hosting us at the McKinsey offsite.
Not at all. Glad you guys are having fun.
Yeah. It sort of sets a nice setting for a hopefully reflective conversation. So look forward to this.
Sure.
Maybe a good place to start, Pramath, might be to really say you wear multiple hats. Mm-hmm. If you had to sort of talk about the pie chart of the different things you do, give us an insight into what that looks like.
So at this point in my life, I think there are three kind of legs to what I do. Mm-hmm. One is that I'm an entrepreneur and I started something called 9.9 Media a few years ago. And that takes up some of my time, and we continue to operate in the specialist media space where we have some very prominent brands like Digit, mm-hmm. CIO and Leader, IT Next, CFO India. I think our business is really focused around those four brands. And so I continue to do that. My second leg is some interesting consulting work that I continue to do, which a lot of people here don't know about because my clients are generally multinationals. Uh-huh. But I work with Madeleine Albright, former U.S. Secretary of State, on a firm that she started called the Albright Stonebridge Group, which advises multinationals on challenges that they face in international markets. And in our case, I lead their team in India.
Very interesting. Okay.
On the face of it, it is consulting, but it's very different from the typical McKinsey consulting, where it's really at the intersection of politics, business, policy, and the social sector. Hmm. And so the problems kind of are very multidimensional, and the solutions are not obvious. Right. And it requires multiple stakeholder management and a fairly holistic approach. And there we don't only advise, but we actually execute potential way forward. So that's something that takes up some chunk of my time. And then the final thing is the obvious higher education space where I spend time. There it's really between two sort of sets of things. One is a philanthropic, more volunteer set of things, which includes ISB, the two campuses, Ashoka, and something I started a couple of years ago called the Vedika Scholars Program. But in addition to that, I am now starting to do stuff which is more in helping other people improve or build new institutions. Mm-hmm. And that again is more project management mode of literally going and doing a BOT or becoming a BOT partner for people who already own institutions or want to build institutions, to say, given my experience, let me do something for you which is really high quality, either to improve what you have or to build something new.
Very interesting. And one thing I'm always curious about is, in your case, you have a portfolio of different things, high impact things you do. How do you think about impact and success? Is there some sort of a yardstick you set for yourself in the context of what you're doing?
Yes, I do. I mean, I think these things are also different, that it's hard to say that there's any one yardstick. But I think if I reflect on it, there's always an internal metric and an external metric. I think one thing, and there is a very personal metric, which I'll come to. Mm-hmm. So I think on the external metric, my yardstick is really, and a lot of this came out of the McKinsey experience, that are the clients, are the people I'm working with, are the customers or people I'm catering to, mm-hmm. High quality people with the right values and right intents, that I enjoy working with them, and we have a set of a mutual respect for each other. Mm-hmm. I think it's, in all cases, there has to be high aspiration. So mm-hmm. I'm not getting into those kind of metrics. So you have to be world class, or you have to do something that impacts a lot of people. Sure. I think those can vary, and everybody would talk about this. But for me, the relationship and the quality of people, in McKinsey, we used to say quality of client and quality of impact that you're having,
right,
have to go together. So I think that is the one big metric that I try to use. Sometimes impact may be small, but they're good people and you want to help them out. Mm-hmm. So I think that's very much something that guides me as I look at what I do externally or who I engage with. The second is that I also want to do things where I'm able to attract good people. I think in my kind of model, where I'm doing multiple things, it's very dependent on having a high quality set of people. Otherwise, you possibly can't do so many things.
Right.
And so then to be able to say that, listen, am I doing things in a way, or am I working on things and I'm doing it in a way that attracts high quality people to me, who on one hand I can depend on and I can leverage, and on the other hand I can be a mentor to and help them be successful in what they want to do. That, I think, together with the quality of people you're working with on the outside, gives me the measure for what I'm doing and why I'm doing it. And then finally, it all really comes down, I think, as you grow older in life, to, you know, what is the sense of satisfaction and sense of purpose that you draw from these things you do. And on one hand, it may seem that I do a bunch of unrelated things which have a myriad of very different outcomes, problems, contexts. But underlying all of this is that, you know, for me, Pramath, and not for you or other people, mm-hmm. What seems fulfilling, satisfying, purposeful, taking into account some of the practical realities of life, that I have to earn some money or, sure, you know, take care of my future.
Right.
That's really what then determines success or what you want to do.
Got it. Completely with you about the fact that it's so individual specific often,
yeah,
and context specific. Let's rewind the clock, Pramath, and maybe even going back to the point when you joined McKinsey. You're an IIT alumnus, and then you had a PhD from UPenn. At that time, why McKinsey?
Yeah, honestly, sometimes there are points in life where you don't know why you take something up, and it's often in reaction to not liking something else, mm-hmm. Rather than knowing what you're getting into. So it wasn't like I knew what I was getting into with McKinsey, but I was quite unhappy being an academic at that point in time. And it was doubly disappointing because I had worked very hard up till that point to become an academic or,
right,
to get the PhD. And then to find that in the profession itself, there was a lot of politics. There was a lot of confusion about people like me who came from a very interdisciplinary, multidisciplinary background. And I just think I was in the wrong context, in the wrong milieu. I had moved from the US to Canada thinking that that's where better opportunities were, and that I could be a bigger frog in a small pond. They offered me a good position, and so on and so forth. And it often happens in life. It's not just then. I now realize that every second move I make is a wrong move. And then you correct yourself, and then you find that that corrected move becomes the best move you took. So this has almost been a pattern, at least in my life. So I think it was one of those moves that was probably a wrong move. If I had gone into another university where the context was right, I may still be an academic today, you know, for all you know, doing research in robotics. So I had this very tough challenge where I was not enjoying the atmosphere I was in and what I was doing. And it was then that a bunch of friends who used to work at McKinsey approached me and said, hey, McKinsey is looking for diversified hires who, interestingly, when you look at it now, you know, were non-MBAs. You know, it's like we don't know what other way to classify these guys who don't have MBAs.
The rest of the world.
Yeah. So it's like we are hiring non-MBAs. And I literally, the person who referred this to me said, if you are successful, then I get to donate $500 to my favorite charity. They have a referral program going. So I was first very perplexed and said, I knew about McKinsey because I was at Penn and Wharton was there. And I knew all the Indians who went to Wharton all went to McKinsey and they lusted after McKinsey. So I knew it was a big deal for the MBAs, but I never thought I would be actually looking at working there. But then I realized that they had been hiring PhDs. And then what really worked for me was that the Toronto office where they sent me to interview once I applied was in fact full of people who did not have MBAs. So I suddenly saw people like me working there, interviewing me, and being very much like me and seemingly enjoying the place. And I've always been a bit of a risk taker and I like doing different things. So that's how I said, why not? And very quickly realized that it was a good decision, that it actually felt more like my PhD days than my academic days, because it was people from all different backgrounds. It was very multidisciplinary. I was given a lot of respect for my PhD from day one. People started calling me rocket scientist, literally because of my robotics background and so on. So it was a great ride.
Got it. And maybe cutting to the present, given the work you do with ISB and Vedika, how should people think about consulting as the first job, right? And I ask this because when I went to IIM, for example, I didn't have work experience. And a lot of people, I guess ISB is a little different, but out of curiosity, I'm quite curious about type 1 and type 2 errors, right? In these situations where who are the people that join consulting but very quickly realize they're not cut out? And who are the people that could have been great consultants but never end up joining for the wrong reasons? Do you have a view on that?
See, my view is that while there is a lot of emphasis on hiring people who have, you know, very high IQ, and that's what the McKinseys and others of the world do when they go out and recruit. I think while that is almost a necessary condition in consulting, because people do pay the big bucks to have very smart people consult for them. I think we forget that a second necessary condition has to be that this is a person who really enjoys working with people, both internally and externally. And honestly, the ability to engage, I'm not saying you have to be nice and inspirational and all those fancy things, but you should have an interest in engaging with other human beings, right? This is a contact sport. And a lot of people don't realize that. They take the McKinsey offer or McKinsey makes offers because it's very difficult to judge whether a person is cut out for a contact sport or not. So it's a little bit like, you know, do you want to play chess and tennis or squash or golf? Maybe not golf, that has some interaction to it, but certainly versus a team sport like a football or a hockey or a cricket, where they are all sports, but they're very different personalities who succeed, and there's skill involved, which obviously you want to be good at whatever you do. But I think there's a certain kind of person who will fit into a team sport environment and a certain kind of person who would not play team sports and be more individual driven. And I think that's the call that I think most people don't realize.
And it's also about not winning, but enabling the clients to win, which requires a certain people.
Yeah, so then there's a whole set of other things that comes with, you know, making others successful, being comfortable in letting go and, and being good at dealing with conflict and so on. The working hard and so on bit, I think, goes with every job these days. But I really do think that your ability to connect with people, whether it's your teams internally over time and with clients from day one, the kind of jobs consultants do, is very, very critical in success, being successful as a consultant. And you have to really look at yourself and say, am I that kind of person? Do I really have it in me to, you know, start a conversation from nothing, right? Break an awkward moment that inevitably happens in a consulting client relationship. Not get phased by conflict or resistance, and how to have the confidence to deal with that. You know, these are all becoming much more required in a consulting career. We always were, but I think even today there's greater primacy to these things.
Just picking up consulting as a career, Pramath, again, if I look at people that pass through the hopper all the way to becoming directors, senior directors, and having long tenures in the firm, that ends up being a small minority in a lot of other situations. But consulting, of all other professions, often ends up being a means to an end for a lot of people in terms of being a set of experiences that people leverage in other environments. So I'm always curious about how people should think about transitioning from, let's say, a path, consulting path forward versus branching off either at a manager level or a partner level or a director level. Given your journey and the journeys of others you've seen through, how, what are your thoughts on, you know, how people should think about that?
You know, I personally feel that everyone's journey is different, and I know that's nothing, not saying much. I think somewhere you take up a McKinsey or a consulting role because it's prestigious, it connotes success. And in your mid-20s, when you really join McKinsey, your big metric is to find something that will lead you to being successful. Being successful in your career, which is usually from, you know, the point of view of the role and the job being viewed by your peer group, parents, families as prestigious, and also that it will put you on a path to being well-to-do from a compensation and money perspective. I think somewhere along the way, we all as human beings, and this is not specific to consulting, move from a model of saying it's about going for success to it being about going for fulfillment, purpose, and happiness.
Right.
And I should say success versus happiness, but you know, happiness sometimes people think of as a corny thing, but I mean it literally that this is not the fun and pleasure kind of happiness, it's the satisfaction and purposeful and meaning kind of happiness.
Yeah.
So I think we all have that in us, but somewhere, you know, there are people who actually shun corporate jobs and go and work in a not-for-profit or will join a grassroots organization and say, I want to live my life that way.
Sure.
Some of us don't take that decision early on in life. But as you go through life, you start measuring your life, as it were, in terms of not success, but in terms of happiness and in terms of purpose and in terms of fulfillment. And that's when you start asking the question, is this the life for me? And what am I really doing here?
Right.
Now, at which point you switch really depends on you. For some people, they are so ingrained in it that for them, maybe that is the purpose, maybe that is what gives them happiness. But at least for me, at some point, it started to mean less and less. I think when I went to ISB and came back, I realized the futility of being in a life where I had not experienced doing anything by myself. I felt McKinsey was too protected. And that I really, my real strengths came out when I did things, when I took the thinking and applied it and took it to the next level. And I forward integrated, as it were, from just being a consultant. And so coming back was never the same. And not many people have that luxury or privilege of actually having gone and tasted the real world. So internally, you are always sitting there thinking, oh, I'm only good enough for this. Especially with people like me, hey, I was not even meant to be in business. So I'm really, you suffer from this whole imposter syndrome that I was never supposed to be in business. Here I am advising governments, prime ministers, building universities and so on. Where else would or who else would give me this opportunity? So you better stay here. It's a safe space. Then you go out and you taste blood and you say, wow, you know, that's actually what I enjoy more. And that's actually what I'm really good at. This stuff I have to sometimes struggle with, right? And then you start asking yourself the question that what do you really want to do? And, you know, by then in McKinsey, I had started doing a lot of work around leadership. And I used to say to myself that, you know, how can I be an authentic consultant or guide on leadership when I'm not sure that I understand my own leadership or how am I developing as a leader and what really... And so why not throw myself out there and challenge my own leadership and learn about my own leadership before I can start imparting gyan to others, right, on how to become a better leader. A lot of people argued with me that, hey, you can experiment with that internally in the firm. And honestly, I felt I couldn't. At least the kind of challenges I wanted to throw myself, there was a massive firm hierarchy and structure within which I had to navigate. And I really, you always had to work with other people, you had to pick one of the practices, if you charted your own practice, you had to get a director to work with you, and so on and so forth. At that point, I started finding the firm restricted, both in terms of what being a consultant meant, which is to hold yourself back from actually doing anything, and being just an advisor, to the other aspect of saying, do you really have freedom to do what you want from a life purpose perspective? Yes, some people chance upon it, but most people in the firm had to kind of go into the mold of how practices and so on were defined. So yeah, so at that point, this whole purpose and meaning thing started to overshadow my perceived happiness or success that I was getting from what I was doing. And that's when I decided to leave.
Sure. And Pramath, you spoke about going to ISB, setting it up, and so on. But one of the pieces I'm curious about is directionally, I think when people reach senior levels in a firm like McKinsey, when you become a director, number one, you're operating in a stratified layer where there aren't that many opportunities that sort of qualify to merit your consideration. And also the stakes become higher. Having built such a precious career, you want to be careful about the next step. What are some of the thoughts on how people should answer the question about where to play next, right? And what are the mistakes you see people make just in getting the direction right?
Yeah, you know, I think there is no answer to this. I mean, my view of this is that, you know, what you're looking for when you're looking for something is, again, some combination of predicting that taking on something will lead to success and happiness or happiness and success. And to me, it's a mug's game. I mean, it's very difficult to predict whether something will work or not. And so you almost have to go in there thinking, hey, this is not my last job. I'm making an informed judgment. It may not work out. And if it doesn't work out, there's something that will come after that. Now, it seems a bit fatalistic when I say it that way, and I don't quite mean it that way. Of course, you do the due diligence. Of course, you go reflect and you think and you talk to your spouse and talk to your mentors and friends and take an informed judgment of what you should do. But, you know, I think often when people seem very sure of what they want to do, I would still give them the same advice that, listen, what you think you are very sure about, you can get disillusioned very quickly because you don't really know what the world holds for you. So I think if you are going to do something, thinking hard about, to me, I would err on the side of saying, is there real purpose and meaning and happiness that will come from what I want to do, rather than chasing success. And I think then success will follow. Because if you are not finding that, then it may not be worth leaving McKinsey. Because from a success standpoint, you are very successful. It's the best firm in the world to work with, I would still say. You earn well. People respect you at some level while you are running around a lot and working hard. It's a familiar environment. So why would you leave it to go to find some other success? This success is good enough. So you should only leave, I think, when there is greater purpose or meaning, and I keep coming back to that.
Very interesting. Yeah,
when you find something that really is fulfilling, rather than say, let's become an entrepreneur. You should become an entrepreneur if that's what gives you meaning. But it's not true that that is where you will be most successful, unless you find meaning in that.
Very interesting. And since you mentioned this, again, clearly we are witnessing an entrepreneurial boom in terms of a lot of the alumni becoming entrepreneurs. Any watch outs? Again, entrepreneurship, sometimes there's a certain romantic notion attached with the notion.
Yeah.
Any watch outs or any thoughts on just the questions people should ask themselves before they take the plunge?
Yeah, I like to say this to people, and I learned this in McKinsey when I was there, that I think a lot of people take the entrepreneurial plunge because they're quite taken with the sexiness of their idea. So it's like, you know, it's like saying that I'm going to get married because I'm dating a beautiful woman, right? Because obviously somebody being beautiful is not the only reason you should get married to them. And what most people don't realize that actually, like management consulting is a profession, or being a lawyer or a doctor is a profession, entrepreneurship is a way of life and it's a profession. And you have to care about the profession more than what you do today as a job or, you know, working in a large organization, than care only about the idea. A lot of people get carried away. Oh, I have this wonderful idea. And if somebody else can start a digitally enabled laundry service and be so successful, my idea will also be successful. And I think what people have to first ask themselves is, hey, do I want to be an entrepreneur? Do I have this real strong urge to start up something and do something on my own, regardless of the idea? Because actually you start your next laundry service and 6 months later you realize it doesn't work. What are you going to do then? You're going to go back and take up another job. In which case, I would say then you are not cut out for entrepreneurship in the first place. That was the wrong way to think about it. A true entrepreneur will say, hey, this didn't work. Let me go find something else to do. And something else to do, and something else to do. And in fact, most entrepreneurs don't make good on the first big idea that they think they have, right? They have to pivot and sometimes go into a completely new business model and go 2-3 times before they can be successful, or never at all. But they love entrepreneurship so much.
It's a great insight. It's a way of life. It's not about the idea, but it's about a way of dealing with life. And you used a very powerful word, authentic leadership.
Yeah.
I'm curious about what the word authentic means to you. I know different people have different takes on it, but what do you have in mind when you say that, use that word?
Yeah, I mean, I have a very simple definition of that. I think you have to be authentic that, you know, your so-called perception as a leader your stature, if I can use that word, recognition as a leader comes from real achievement and not just talk and not just sort of fluff and just because you're a smart guy or, you know, you talk well and you dress well and you're presentable. And there are too many such people floating around. I think, you know, the question is, what have you got to really show for your so-called leadership? And so there's an authenticity that comes from having demonstrated that you can get something done. And to me, there's a certain other authenticity that comes from the other aspect of leadership, which I think is very important, is have you really helped other people be successful? And then there's a third dimension to this, which is really around how open are you to feedback and change and really pushing yourself to achieve your best potential and overcoming some of the more difficult challenges, having the courage to face your weaknesses and so on. And that is such an important aspect of what people say anybody needs to do to become a leader, that you can't expect that of others if you haven't put yourself through that challenge. You can't advise others to take feedback if you are not open to feedback. You can't advise others to change their behaviors or mindsets or attitude unless you have actually gone through that and seen how tough it is and what personal price sometimes you have to pay. So authenticity to me comes from those three things, you know, being able to really show that your leadership accounts for some achievement, being able to truly have a record of helping people and helping people succeed, not just helping for the sake of helping.
Sure.
And then becoming better leaders. And finally, having the personal life experience that you can relate to when you're teaching somebody or helping somebody or guiding or coaching them, without which it is bookish. I mean, that person can read it somewhere or watch a TED talk and
sure.
do something with it.
I want to move to a different track, Pramath. You've spoken about the different things you do, the 9.9 Media, the consulting with Madeleine Albright and the institutes and at McKinsey. I'm curious about how you think about leadership in these different environments. Personally speaking, how do you flex your style, if you will, for you to operate effectively in these environments?
Yeah, I mean, I haven't given that much thought. In fact, I feel that I have a fairly simple way of looking at leadership, which in fact works in all these environments.
Mm-hmm.
So call it sort of my naivety about this or simple-mindedness about it. But to me, there is actually a general theory that I'm applying
sure.
to these.
Sure.
And it goes back to your question about authenticity. I think leadership, at the end of the day, really amounts to these three things. Number one, how do you deliver breakthrough, disruptive performance each time, as many times as you can? You can't do it each time, is what I have found, but at least you can aim to do it each time. And to say this, there's a normal level of performance that everybody has to deliver, is expected mm-hmm. to deliver, but can I do something that is a breakthrough or disruptive? And unless you do that, to me, that's a necessary condition. You can have all the other conditions I'm going to talk about, but without this, you can't be considered to be a leader, or somebody who aspires to be a leader has to keep this in mind. I think the second thing is what I said earlier again, was about the ability to inspire other people to achieve their full potential, for them to become leaders, for them to be the best they can be. And so how can you help other people succeed? Is a great hallmark that you need to have as a leader. But you can't just do that, because you just do that and not achieve some results, then it's a nice to have trait.
Mm.
And then finally, this trait of people's ability to take feedback, read their sort of performance with on those two dimensions, and say, how do I need to constantly change, evolve? That's where actually the question of, you know, adapting your style or looking at leadership contextually comes into play, because you may need to be a different kind of a leader in a different situation. Your strengths, your weaknesses, and your gaps may play up very differently. So the ability to see that you are not meant for every situation, and different situations require different styles of your own leadership, becomes very important on that dimension. So these three dimensions of breakthrough performance, making others successful, you know, an obsession with personal growth and personal leadership, or leading yourself, is really sort of the three dimensions that I see of leadership. So when I'm assessing somebody, whether it's an interview, whether it's a performance review, or whether it is somebody I'm looking up to as a mentor or
sure.
judging their whether they are worth emulating, these are the three things I'm looking for. What has this person really delivered? What is their track record of helping and getting other people to succeed? And finally, what is the evidence that they have actually done something about themselves, which is different and path-breaking relative to others? Now, if you have these three ingredients, I think these three ingredients don't change very much between...
Yeah, context agnostic.
Yeah, between different situations. Where the context becomes important is, okay, so how do you achieve breakthrough performance in a building an educational institution versus delivering a consulting assignment versus launching a new vertical in 9.9? Those contexts are very different. But ultimately, being focused on the fact that, listen, it's not worth doing if I'm not able to hit the ball out of the park, is the mindset that you want to bring in all three situations, which is common.
Just a related point, Pramath. Once again, in a lot of ways, people, when we move from consulting to other roles, I'm always curious about, you know, often the recruitment decision is made based on what the person has. but the failures often happen because what the person doesn't have. So in terms of the incremental leadership muscle that people need to focus on when they move, do you have views on how people should think about themselves in terms of their development? Consultants, when they move on to, let's say, the industry or private equity, what have been some of your observations in terms of your transitions and the transitions that you see people make effectively?
Yeah, again, I would say two things. One is that given that you've lived the life of a consultant for such a long time, and you kind of live in this belief that whatever you did had massive impact and changed the way a client did things, you assume that whatever you thought of or whatever you came up with actually works in the real world.
Right.
My belief is that most often it doesn't. And when I try, firstly, when you go out into the real world, you don't have the time for that much thinking and consideration and reflection and analysis that goes into a typical consulting report. So you're taking decisions with much shorter lead times, with much less input, and you have to decide and you have to move ahead. And a lot of times things don't work and you have to do a lot more of try it, measure it, fix it, try it, measure it, fix it. You kind of do it that way rather than having a very deliberate strategy mm-hmm. for everything. So I think recognizing that you instinctively have cognitive bias, you have decision-making paralysis, that your decisions that you are used to making with a lot more, and which may inform your quick judgment today are actually going to be, by definition, off the mark because they don't factor in the implementation challenges. Just being aware that however smart you may be, don't assume that you know what it is to work in that environment or in the real world is very important. And I think the second thing is really to then go with a mindset saying, listen, I've been living in an ivory tower for 10 years and this is like now taking on my first job. So yes, I bring in great skills and that's a great starting point and a foundation. But honestly, my gaps are really big gaps where I'm actually at a zero. It's not like I've got some partial information. I assume that, you know, I don't know this at all because of the protected environment I've been in. And therefore being, again, very open to saying, how do I learn? Giving yourself time to learn.
Correct.
So one of the mistakes I feel I made is that I was in too much of a hurry when I went and became the CEO of this other company. I wasn't conscious of how important slowing down change is for an organization rather than, you know, I came from a consulting mindset of transformation, PMO banao, launch newish initiatives. People will change, they'll be inspired, I'll inspire them.
And there's a bias for pace. Right?
Yes. And then suddenly you realize that this is not a 3-month project, this is not a 6-month assignment, this is not a one-year PMO where you have to actually show that you delivered the cost savings. You're playing a long-term game and there are people involved. There's somebody who's worked in an organization for 30 years and you're saying, hey, this guy doesn't fit into my structure. You can't just get rid of that person because tomorrow you get rid of that person, you're owners or your shareholders or whoever, promoters feel like, you know, how did you just fire somebody who was such a loyalist? Do you know what I went through and how he stood by me? How can you just do that? Right? So all kinds of other issues start to play up, which doesn't fit into the framework of an analytic, approach.
True.
So that has been my biggest learning, to not be in a hurry. Consulting somehow puts you into this treadmill of 3-month, 4-month projects, right? Everything has to be done yesterday. Things have to be over-delivered, right? To get off this clock and say, hey, this is a long-term game I'm playing. You know, if I'm going to be in this role for 3 years, then let me take my time to listen, get to know people, build credibility, look at how can I build trust, all of those things. And there's no hurry, you know, it's okay. I can deliver the cost savings next year, but this year is really 1 year of induction and getting to know people.
Got it. And also to your point, really having the ability to analyze the impact of a decision on the various stakeholders and what the sensitivities might be in a certain culture, what the landmines are and so on.
If this is a topic of interest, you might like my conversation with Ravi Venkatesan, who had multiple transitions. He moved from a senior role in Cummins in the US to India. He then moved from leading Cummins in India to heading Microsoft in India to very different industries, and then moved on from Microsoft to take on several board roles. And he spoke about the criticality of listening when you move across contexts. This piece can be found in Nugget 6.06.
So from this, you begin to piece together first the situation, and then out of that emerges a theory of change, which is, you know, what interventions are really going to make a difference and who are going to be the important allies in this. If you don't listen and you start immediately, you come in with a point of view, you start, you know, jumping into action right away, you're going to make a lot of mistakes because you haven't built this nuanced and reasonably accurate picture of the landscape.
If you find this podcast purposeful, please take a moment to subscribe and spread the word by going to iTunes to rate and review. And thank you for listening. Now let's get back to my conversation with Pramath.
Changing tack, Pramath, I want to talk about women leaders. If we looked at just sort of women growing all the way to become leaders, I'd be curious on your take on where you see the bottlenecks. What are the, if we had to sort of really say, what are the 3-4 things that need to be de-bottlenecked in that pipeline for us to have more leaders flowing through?
See, one thing there is that there's a lot of unconscious bias that still exists across all stages of a woman's career, which they have to fight. In general, the family still places a greater premium on the boy's education. In general, there is a suggestion that women need not be pushed to achieve their best, and that ultimately they're going to get married and then they'll fend for themselves with their husbands. And I've seen this happen in some of the more evolved and educated and elite. Some would argue that socioeconomically, as you grow higher up the strata, it becomes even more pronounced. So I don't know what the sociological aspect of this is, but somewhere there is a lot of bias that still exists right through your growing up years, through your education. And then what has very become very obvious is that despite the fact that if you look at the numbers graduating from high school and getting the best marks and so on, women outnumber men. Yet when you go to boardrooms, if you look into MBA programs, engineering programs, if you look at corporate India, the numbers are abysmal. And there's a lot of data on this out there, but it's very stark. It's almost women are not there. And I really think that the barriers to entry are several. It starts at, they're there at all stages. Like I said, you know, a boy would be sent to an English medium school, a girl would be sent to the vernacular school. A boy will be giving coaching for JEE, the girl would be sort of asked to fend on her own. If the boy got into a NIT in Hamirpur, which is at the, from Kerala, he would be sent. But the woman wouldn't be sent. They would say, why don't you study in the local college? And the story repeats itself. You know, so if you want to do an MBA, the same story happens. Boy gets to do cat coaching. Woman gets to fend for herself. Boy gets into, if not an IIM, a MICA. He goes to Ahmedabad. But girl gets to study MBA at a local college. So people are getting left behind, I feel. At the other end, when it comes to the employment, I don't think employers are really able to grasp the fact that you have to adjust yourself to accommodate the life trajectories of a woman. I think McKinsey is particularly guilty of this, right? I mean, as a firm, we started the profession of management consulting. It's the biggest challenge for the profession. And McKinsey should take the lead on this, is how do we have 50% women in consulting, right? What will it take? What is the management consulting model? Just as you hired non-MBAs and now 50% of the firm is non-MBAs, how do you make sure that you can have a career trajectory that accommodates children and marriage or vice versa? So I think that is where we are failing.
And to make that tactical, Pramath, so any what do good organizations do? Just if we double click on that, around those two transition points, any headline takeaways?
Yeah, I think do away with tenure-based promotions, right? Do away with, you know, you have to become so-and-so in such and such time. Change the evaluation criteria. I mean, what is so sacrosanct about evaluation criteria, right? I mean, there's a very different evaluation criteria for admitting somebody to ISB from admitting somebody to a Young India Fellowship program, which is a one-year liberal arts course. But, you know, those two people are getting the same jobs, right? They are all going and working in the same organizations. They are earning similar salaries, right? So you can see that using two very different criteria, you're producing the same output. You're getting the same product, or at least the market is valuing the product in the same way. They're not saying these people are less or more. So why are we doing that here? I think we are really caught. It's like when ISB first came out, nobody wanted to hire our guys because they said, what do we do with them? You know, this is not campus. These are lateral hires. So how do we hire them? I know I'm used to hiring MBAs. Somewhere society and corporates and business has to change to accommodate a different stream of people coming in. So your assessment has to change, right, of who you hire and what qualities are you looking for. You have to become much more flexible about saying that, hey, people's trajectories do change when they have kids. I met a bunch of women who came out of the first batch of ISB 15 years ago, and their biggest regret is that, unlike their male colleagues, they have not been able to sustain their careers. And then they say, we go back to the workforce and people ask us all kinds of funny questions, and their insinuations about where we should be placed in the hierarchy and what compensation we should make. And I think somewhere women also need to be educated that, you know, sure, just as when you came out of ISB, we would tell people, hey, it's not your first job that is important, but your trajectory. At the same time, here also women need to understand that, hey, if you're not working for so long, you can't expect to go back to where you were. And yes, your male colleagues are going to be a few steps behind, ahead of you, and that's all right.
Sure.
I think this is what we are trying to do in a small way at Vedika. So at Vedika, we are intervening at the MBA point. Mm-hmm. And we are saying, listen, you don't need a CAT score, firstly. Mm-hmm. Don't stress about your tests. Then we say, listen, I'm not hung up about your minimum cutoff, or if you went to a nondescript college in Telangana before you came here, it's fine if I haven't heard of your college. But you need to show to me that you are really committed, that you want this kind of education, and that you're going to work hard to put yourself into a different orbit by virtue of this program.
And how do you screen for that, Pramath?
Interview. Hmm. Interview, have a bunch of conversations. You can't do a perfect job, but equally, you can at least ask the right questions. What's your commitment? What is your life experience? Are you, you know, and the usual thing we used to do at McKinsey, I've been using all of that. You know, are you interesting? Are you interested? And can I really help this person achieve what I want to do and what they want to do? So we use very subjective criteria. We try to make it as objective as possible. But keeping it simple and saying, hey, if this person is enthusiastic and showing commitment, let's take her.
Got it.
Right. And, you know, often people come in class and say, oh, okay, I'm in a peer group that, you know, these women are not as good as me, or they're not as smart as me, and what am I doing here? But people over time realize that that's not the only metric, right? The drive, the commitment, everybody has their own strengths and weaknesses. So I think that's the one thing, where getting them in. And then through the program, what we try to do is we do a combination of management, liberal arts, critical thinking, communication, and leadership courses, right? Mm-hmm. With equal measure. Now that's a huge departure from what a typical management course does. And in the leadership piece, we really give them a lot of exposure to women who are inspiring in terms of the careers they've had, so that these women can have conversations at an early stage about what they could be up against as they went forward. Rather than assuming that, no, you'll be fine now that you've got an MBA, you're on a track, and then these people being hit by a roadblock very quickly, we say, no, this is an important conversation to have. How do you sustain careers? How have people sustained careers? Listen, there's no one model. Look at all these women.
Multiple journeys, yeah.
Yeah. Their journeys are all different. But remember, you have to be focused on sustaining the career. Don't give up. It's not worth giving up. And so on. So it's still a confidence in them that, listen, yes, it's going to be difficult. Yes, I'm going to get married. Yes, I'm going to have kids. But, you know, other people have done it. I can also do it. Here's some ways to think about it. And plan for it rather than sort of let it happen to you.
If this topic is of interest, you might want to tune into my next podcast conversation with Vedika Bhandarkar. At this stage, I must say that the name Vedika is just a random coincidence, given that we just spoke about the Vedika Scholars program that Pramutha started. She's one of the several women leaders who've come from ICICI Bank. She headed Credit Suisse in India before moving to the social impact world, and she now heads Water.org in India. Water.org empowers families with access to safe water and sanitation through affordable financing. Now, back to the podcast chat with Pramuth.
Pramuth, picking up from some of the stuff you've discussed, you're a person who has a unique insight at two different levels. One is at the education level, when people are graduating, and then at the leadership level, given the work you do. Given the changes that are happening in the education system and in the world of leadership, I'd be curious to know how people should think about educational choices. In a way, at Ashoka, you have an insight into liberal arts, women's education. At ISB, you have an insight into B-School. And I'm curious about two or three trends we are seeing, Pramuth. One is, you know, the timing of education. Earlier, it was sort of study, work, retire. It was very distinct. But now, clearly, it seems education and learning is more of a journey than a one-off. Second, when I look at the nature of education, it seems to be unbundled from clunky degrees to, you know, bespoke courses people can configure along the way. So how should somebody in the 10th or 11th or 12th think about direction? And how should people think about it as they go through the journey?
Yeah, you could come at this from either end, right? But the two are connected. The leadership that's required for people to be successful in the future and the preparation through education that is needed for them to be successful in the future or be good leaders in the future.
Yeah.
Maybe we start with the end of at the end of what's required going forward. And, you know, different people have said different things about, but the essence of it is that, one, we really don't know, but two, it's very clear that the, at least for the very best of people, the challenges that they are going to face are going to be fairly ambiguous, and it's not going to be solvable, as it were, with just taking one approach.
Yeah,
and so, to be successful, you have to recognize that you aren't going to be able to solve the problem that you're going to be faced with or challenged with by yourself, by one approach that you learned, that you're going to have to look at things from a multidimensional perspective, multidisciplinary perspective, that you may be wrong in what you come up with, and you have to have the ability to adapt and be flexible and to adopt other strategies, and that you have to pull in other people to help you solve the problem, because by definition the problem will not be solvable by you alone.
Yep.
And in very short order you will have to very quickly re-educate or educate yourself about the domain that you're getting into, and almost do multiple PhDs throughout your career. Other people say this in another way, which is that, you know, you're not going to have one career, but you're going to have half a dozen careers,
right,
in your life.
Right.
And over time, maybe even more as the world changes faster and faster. So the question becomes that with these kinds of problems, with these expectations of a leader tomorrow, with these kinds of career progressions, what do you do by way of education?
Yep.
So coming back to that end, I think it's you've already alluded to some of that. One is that you have to break away from this obsession about specialization. Mm. And this is not to say that specialization is not good, but that specialization and generalization, or breadth and depth, are more relevant. You need depth, of course, because you need to understand what it takes to go deep into a problem quickly and rapidly, which has now become the ask. So it's not like we are saying, oh, everybody should be a generalist. Absolutely not. You must know how to specialize, but you must know how to specialize rapidly and have many specializations in your life. At the same time, you need to have the ability to have a broader perspective, which comes from the breadth. And I think that's where this whole debate between liberal arts and STEM has come from. And I think it's a false debate and it's a false trade-off. You need both. And that has always been what education was about. But particularly here in India, with the post-independence focus on developing the technical capability of the country, we went too far in that direction, and we haven't corrected that at all. And the liberal arts colleges and universities have declined at the expense of, because of the growth of the technical fields. So I think bringing in breadth and liberal arts, which is somewhat what we are trying to do at Ashoka, or what I've done at Vedika in combining it with business and doing something else with architecture and liberal arts and so on. So both specialization and generalized education is extremely important. I think the second bit of this, which is very important, and I think this goes to the heart of when people say, how come people in India, the same people don't do as much innovation or don't create products or don't do breakthrough scientific discoveries as they would in the United States or in other parts of the world when they have the same basic education and genes and DNA. I think the fundamental issue with that is that at the lowest level of our education and going all the way up to the highest level, we are not providing people choice. And the fundamental choice of being able to choose what you study. And, you know, people often counter that and say, well, how do people ever know? And it's true, people never know. But the act
The process of going through it. Yes.
The process of going through having to make a choice is a very big part of education and mindset in terms of risk taking and pushing thinking and really identifying what are you passionate about. And I, for a long time now, I've believed that unless you are happy doing what you're doing or passionate doing what you're doing, you don't have breakthrough performance or breakthrough thinking. So here, what has ended up happening is that we are constantly at every stage forcing people to choose based on their performance in an exam, the marks they got, the rank they got, and so on. Moreover, once you choose something, you are stuck. So even if you come to the conclusion that, oh, I chose something that I was perhaps not right about or didn't really know but now realize is not right, you can't switch. So if you get into a program at an IIT and you're studying metallurgical engineering, which is what I did, and you're hating it, and you can't really do anything about it.
Right, right. The switching costs are high. Right?
Switching costs are, I mean, zero. Infinite. I mean, you cannot change. Right. So the point is that, you know, you not only do you get stuck, you don't have any flexibility. So this combination of choice and flexibility is really what I think is, along with this point about having breadth along with depth is really what we need to bring into our education system to allow our young people to prepare for that world we talked about.
Got it. And if I were to make this question tactical, if I'm an individual who sort of finished my 10th and I have the universe of options staring at me, law, commerce, finance, engineering, liberal arts, and so on, when people come and ask you the question, are there one or two questions you ask them to reflect on, which will help the broad choice?
Yes, I, you know, first thing I do is I ask them to listen to what their children is are saying, rather than deciding for them. And that I see is a huge problem because, you know, I think our parents were much less concerned about what we were doing, even though at that time I think it was very important.
It was a bigger deal, possibly. Yeah.
But today what has happened is, ironically, even with the large number of choices in careers, the choices in education are very limited still.
Interesting.
So that forces people to become very, very focused on saying, oh, I have to decide, right? Mm. And so the first thing I really ask them is, are you deciding for your kid, or do they really want to study law, for example? And often you will find kids who are very clear that they're very excited about being a lawyer. And if that's really what they want to do, and honestly, between you and me, objectively, they may not know.
True.
But the important part is that they are excited about it and they want to pursue it. And so first and foremost, just clarifying that. Then if you end up on the other side where the person doesn't know, I then start by saying, listen, it's good that you, it's okay that you don't know. There's nothing wrong with that, because otherwise people are under pressure that they are confused or they don't know.
They ought to know the answer.
They ought to know, and how come they don't know, and so on. So taking that pressure off and then helping them understand that honestly, what you specialize in will not matter. In fact, this whole thing about, you know, specializing in a subject and then being in a career, and the line to that, as you know, is tenuous. It happens sometimes, but increasingly happens less and less. And so while it's important to major in something, it's not really that important to major in the right thing.
That's a good point.
And so that kind of releases the tension of a lot of parents and children when they realize, or sometimes they don't, but most of times you can actually show the parents themselves that what they major in and what they're doing now has no connection.
It puts the choice in perspective, right?
Correct. And so that then opens up a whole host of possibilities about what this kid could do. And I think that's when you move to the point of saying, okay, so what are your choices really?
Got it.
And there are a host of choices. I mean, you could choose to go just study science or psychology or history or go abroad or stay in India. Or and it takes the pressure off having to get the decision right. So I think those are the kind of, that I didn't give you the 3-4 questions, but I think that's the thought process of very tactically of what you go through.
And also interesting, it's also about setting the right climate in which the choice is made, right? Yes. And as a parent, I guess it's also important to set the right climate where the pressure is taken off, as you said.
Yeah, and a lot of times, to be fair, the pressure is also on the parents, right? Because they're looking at their peers, and some of their peers are sending, now we have people sending their kids to high school in the UK for some reason, or and it's like, okay, now what's happening here? And so they are all wondering whether they are doing something not right by their kids by not sending them, and so on. So I think there's a lot of pressure on parents also. And so you kind of, by just first easing that peer pressure, you are helping them think.
Got it. And moving forward, Pramath, for a minute, if I were to reflect on some of the entrepreneurial activity we are seeing, and in the limited interactions I've had, I see a lot of people who have a strong product idea, who've often come from a, let's say, one of the disciplines, right, whether it's engineering or science, who've stumbled upon the path of entrepreneurship. And clearly, as the organization scales up, they also need to scale up their leadership capability. And I was talking to Nandan Nilekani a few weeks back, and he was making the point that India has a lot of startups, but fewer scale-ups. And he alluded to what it took to develop the leaders. And if I may sort of go back to one of the earlier things you said, Pramath, about the work you do with Albright Stonebridge Group, which talks about just navigating complex ecosystems and stakeholders and the various things involved. Just give us an insight into how some of these young founders who come from, let's say, one of the domains now need to suddenly start building the leadership capability, which requires them to exercise many more muscles. What's your take on what does it take for them to individually scale up the leadership capability?
Well, I think Nandan is right. And I also feel that a lot of these startups not scaling up are really leadership failures rather than idea failures, and I think what people see are all the successes. So they see a Zuckerberg, or they see a Jobs, or a Gates, and some of these are examples of people who nearly didn't complete college, they did not do enough, they didn't have any entrepreneurial history either, and they hit it big.
Yeah.
right? But you know, that's almost like a lottery to my mind. I mean, these are extremely talented people and you have to give them credit for their persistence and so on. Equally, there are many, many more such talented people who didn't make it, right? We can't look at the example of these few people and say, all of us will be successful. And it's great that they are inspiring people to go on to start and so on. But there are two or three elements that people are missing out on. Number one, I have always believed, and I think it's true even if you study the lives of these people, that entrepreneurship is actually not about the idea. It's about being an entrepreneur, right? It's a way of life. And you have to love entrepreneurship and not your idea.
Interesting.
If you're an entrepreneur, then you will just persist and you may start with one idea and you'll give it up and you'll pivot and you'll adapt and you'll go into adjacent spaces and so on. And that's how all these guys have been successful. If you study their history, I think a lot of the people who are starting ventures today are really one trick ponies. And I don't mean it in a deprecating manner.
Sure.
They are so wedded to a particular idea they got that they're jumping in because they think this is the, you know, best thing since sliced bread. And the truth is that it may not be. And most often is not. And success lies in recognizing that and quickly pivoting. So that's the real essence of entrepreneurship, which they are not, they're not aware of. So they think it's about the bright idea they have. I think the second thing is that being able to scale up your leadership skills is a hugely non-trivial task. Nobody has really talked about that to people. How do you manage just your peers, your top team, people who are more senior than you, more experienced than you, who you inevitably will need to bring in, your founding team will go away and so on. So these are not the issues that you worry about on day one. So you don't know. And you don't know what you don't know about yourself.
Right? True.
So that's the other hidden factor that becomes very quickly limiting, where people are not able to retain other people. They don't know how to scale up, even if they have a successful idea. How do you solve for that? I don't know. I think on the first one, I think you solve. I think on both you solve by mentoring. I feel that, and this is what people like Nandan and others I think are doing or trying to do is some of these folks have to mentor other folks into being successful as entrepreneurs. And I think it's great that we have such a wave of entrepreneurship in this country. But it would be important for some of this learnings to be passed on from generation to generation. Because I'm not suggesting that you should not become an entrepreneur even without experience. And you should, of course, give it a shot. But you should be thinking about the right reasons for success or the right drivers of success, which realization I don't think will come through a self-realization. It will only come through somebody being able to sit you down.
Who's sort of seen the movie.
That's right.
Yeah.
So I think it's true not just for entrepreneurs, but for everyone. I think it's important to have good mentors. It's important to have the humility to say this, and I really don't know this stuff. And I need to sit down with somebody to walk me through this. I think the other small thing, small or big problem I see these days is also that a lot of the investors haven't really been entrepreneurs. At least I remember I don't know what it's like in the US today, but in the early days in Silicon Valley and so on, the bigger VCs and PE guys had all been entrepreneurs. Right. They had actually either been entrepreneurs or they had been sort of involved in entrepreneurial organizations. They had worked and they had built.
Right.
They hadn't just been consultants like you and me, and they hadn't just been people who had been investing all their lives. And I think that somewhere you are not then able to provide that mentorship. You can bring in the money and the resources and how to scale up and, you know, examples of how to monetize and so on. And I think that's very valuable too. But finding people who can scale up leadership skills in proportion to how your business is growing is difficult.
True.
And you have had to live that life. I have seen that between two investors that I had in 9.9, my own venture, where one of the investors had actually built something from scratch. So some of his insights about literally how to scale up your own leadership, how to look at the scaling up of the business, how to think about leading a sales force, was very granular and very, very pithy, which I would have never learned.
Got it.
If somebody hadn't actually gone through that process.
Very interesting. And I was talking to Avnish Bajaj, who's an investor in Matrix Partners, who was an entrepreneur with Bazi.
Yes.
And it was interesting. We spoke about this briefly, and he spoke about the tightrope that the downside he spoke about was if you've done it, then there's a tendency to step in. So it's about bringing that empathy from the past, but without sort of micromanaging, which often...
Which is why I used the word mentor.
Yeah.
Right. Mentors do this very well. As a mentee, you go to a mentor with a problem.
Right.
They will tell you, listen, if I were in your place, here's how I would do it. And then you as a mentee think about that. And you sometimes reject. You say maybe this is the wrong context. You know, he was in a different era. And that could be your arrogance, or that could be your, you know, but you take a call.
Fair.
But at least you have input from somebody who's been there, done that.
Got it.
Rather than having to sort of figure it out yourself.
Got it. And a related point, Pramath, is as we think about the evolving, let's say, the business landscape and the complexity, if I sort of switch back to people in 40s and 50s who in a way built their leadership, for lack of a better term, let's say in the industrial paradigm or sort of the traditional way of businesses, and now we are seeing this new way of dealing with new information, the sort of the velocity of decision making increasing in some of the industries. And as you look at some of your peers in other businesses who are CEOs, what have you seen good leaders do in terms of adapting well to the changing business context?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's no one example, but I think that the people I have seen be successful are those who are somewhat reflective and introspective about failures,
mm-hmm.
And mistakes they made, mm-hmm. where they focus a lot on what could be the learnings that they could take forward, mm-hmm. and how does that, what does that mean for them personally in terms of their own behaviors and attitudes that they have to change. So I have seen some of the most successful people be much more reflective about these things. I think several of them have also then gone on to sort of expose themselves to more and more different situations,
mm-hmm.
Either within or in newer opportunities outside of whatever they were doing,
mm-hmm.
Because they recognize that multiple experiences make you richer and prepare you better for the future from a learning standpoint. I think several of them are using coaches, executive education programs, you know, doing things with peers that are very focused on professional and personal development.
Right.
They seem to understand that self-actualization and finding purpose is not something airy-fairy or spiritual only, that it actually directly impacts your success and then satisfaction from what you do.
Right.
So I think there are a host of these things that I think people are realizing. I think it's tough though, because earlier you didn't need perhaps to do all of this in your work life.
Hmm.
You could do a set of things and be very successful and be quite mechanical and industrial about
it. Right.
And I think in some senses you can, in some contexts, you can still do that and be successful.
Hmm.
But in most contexts, that has completely changed on people. One, the kind of problems you are dealing with.
Right.
And two, the expectations that your own employees have of you.
Hmm.
You know, people want a different kind of workplace.
Right.
They want a different kind of boss. They feel almost entitled that they should all be very respected. And that whatever they do should inspire them, and that they should be excited by the purposefulness of their work and so on.
Right.
So creating that kind of environment for wherever you work, and sometimes in very boring, seemingly less exciting environments, is tough as a leader. And how do you do that is a big challenge.
And how have you thought about your board of advisors, if I may say? People talk about the personal board of directors that sort of guide you. Again, how have you thought about that? Who would you put on the list? If you could provide an insight on how that's evolved over time.
Yeah, it's a good question. I don't think, again, these are one of those, this is a very good example of your earlier answer to your earlier question is how do you build resilience towards a new model for leadership?
Right.
I'm somewhat of more a heart and a guy than a mind guy. So if you look at my board of advisors, my PhD advisor, who I did my PhD with nearly 30 years ago, is somebody I still stay in touch with. She's now at University of California, Berkeley. So every time I go to California, I actually spend time with her and hang out with her. Now, again, she's not directly related to what I do.
Sure.
But where I was headed to was that ultimately people who inspire you, regardless of whether they are related to what you do, are on my board of advisors. Because just a meeting with them, just time spent with them pushes you on to think whatever you are dealing with better or do something that you were struggling with better and so on. So I think she's one example of somebody I have on my board of advisors. Rajat Gupta, who was the managing director of McKinsey, and I spent a lot of time with building ISB, and of course Rajat got into quite a bit of trouble. But, you know, as a person, he's been amazingly inspiring, and particularly with all the troubles he went through with his case and then being in jail and out of it. I really admire Rajat, have always admired him for his ability to think big and yet retain a certain humility and a certain commitment to making other people successful. I stay very close to him, and he's one of clearly my heroes. In spite of everything that has happened and to him and for him. One of my investors, Sanjeev Agarwal of Helion, is somebody that I really look up to. Sanjeev is a good example of somebody who was an entrepreneur, scaled up a business, became an investor. I have to say that, you know, despite being an investor, his selflessness and his sort of almost detachment, which then I think helps him give you very sound advice, even though he could be seen as in conflict.
Domestic party,
has been quite remarkable for me. And I find that very inspiring. So three very different people. But, you know, as you say, who's there, I would say that, you know, I could immediately think of these three people. Who really have been great guideposts over time. One thing I know is that I don't let go of these people when I find them. It doesn't matter if what they are or are not is relevant or not to what I'm doing. Like I said in the beginning, it's really much more about are they inspiring you or not.
Very interesting.
And it doesn't matter whether they have the subject matter expertise.
Got it.
Yeah.
Very interesting. And do you have some sort of a discipline around how you sort of stay in touch with them, or is it sort of more gut driven?
No, you know, I'm not a guy who's very good about staying in touch with people. And especially the way I think about it, you know, my relationships are lifelong, and it doesn't matter if I'm physically or virtually in frequent touch. But yes, I do make an effort to reach out. I do make an effort to be intimate with them when I'm with them. And I think that always rekindles, if there is rekindling, but, you know, that keeps it going.
Got it.
Because people don't feel like you're being artificial or you're just showing up to schmooze or network, which
the
is
intent
which
is clear.
Yeah. And equally, sometimes there are times when I've just called up these people because I needed help, and you hesitate, thinking, you know, oh, I didn't stay in touch, but I'm now calling them because I need help. But I think if you do it the right way, and you do it with not a sense of entitlement, but with a genuine need, then if these people were inspirational in the first place, they will rise up to inspire you even more.
Got it.
Another one of these folks is a McKinsey director, Sun Yen Tse, who was in
Singapore, right?
He's now in Singapore, retired. Used to be in the Toronto office of McKinsey, and we've had a long relationship. And I remember many times, even my career, calling him saying, "Listen, I'm just give me something to do with you." And every time I did that, he would, and that would change my life. And so I think people like that just are there for you, and you kind of know that. So even if you don't see them frequently enough, there's all a bond that is very special that you want to preserve and not give up on.
And just looking ahead, Pramath, how do you think about the life ahead? How do you think about success? How do you think about terms like legacy? What's your sort of plan for the future?
Yeah, that question can have a very, very long answer. So let me be specific in how I'm thinking about this. I feel like I've been very lucky to have had the opportunity to build some really lasting institutions, whether it was ISB, now Ashoka. It's the early days for Vedika, but I'm sure that it'll survive and persist and do well. I'm now involved in a couple of new universities, and I think they will get there too. So I sense a sense, I have a sense of fulfillment about having made a difference and created some of these things. But as I look out ahead, I feel like if I am, worth what I am, if I can take some credit in building these, then I feel like I need to do something that would impact a much larger section of society. At the end of the day, these are all elite institutions, and they cater to very few. Of course, there's sort of broader impact and, sure, and knock-on effect and spin-offs and so on. But one is not trying to do ROI calculations. But I'm just saying that if you really wanted to solve for education, per se, in this country, then the truth is these institutions will help. But the larger scale problem is humongous. And so I'm challenging myself these days to ask, how can the learnings from what I've done be used to leverage to impact a much larger section of society? And eventually, does any of this help me think about effective ways to reach out to people who don't have access to high quality education? And I think there is where my heart ultimately is these days, is pushing myself to think through what can I do that I know from these experiences that can actually impact a much larger section of society. In fact, I'm saying this for the first time on tape or on in public, and I do want to not sound pretentious that I have some very lofty. I don't know the answer,
sure,
honestly.
Sure.
And this is a very personal thing that I'm kind of holding myself to more than anything else, to say, if I'm really worth my salt, then should I not be able to move the needle on the larger problem than having, created a few examples of or islands of excellence?
Very interesting. And maybe looking at the rearview mirror, Pramath, given how far you've come, if you had to be immodest for a couple of minutes and really say, these are the reasons why I was able to do these things that I've been able to do, are there two, three themes about yourself that you reflect upon which have enabled you to deliver the outcomes and build these institutions?
Tough to say, but a few things. I mean, I think my time at McKinsey and my time with Rajat really raised my sights in a way that I don't think was possible. I was this good middle class kid from Patna who was ambitious but didn't quite know what was possible. Didn't know what potentially can be done. So I think that stint at McKinsey and seeing Rajat build these institutions and then him giving me the chance to work alongside on ISB made a huge difference to my raising the sights. I think the second thing is that I think my upbringing in Patna and the school that I went to, and I look at my colleagues from those schools and also IIT Kanpur, I have to say that my school friends and my college friends are all very modest and humble human beings, and they've done amazing stuff. So there was something about the milieu that I was lucky to be part of, where you could have come out with a very strong sense of entitlement or edges or arrogance. But I was never exposed. I never saw that. And I still don't see that in my friends from that time. And I think that has always been at the back of my mind as I have gone off to do stuff. And I'll tell you where it makes a difference, because, you know, you might say, well, that's a very nice thing to say, but that's what everybody says. It's not so unique about your background. I think that what that does is, and somebody recently said this to me, that if you don't forget where you came from, right, if you don't forget that leadership is actually about never forgetting where you came from, that places in a position where you can really move mountains. Because you see how far you've come. And then you say, my God, if that's what I could do in the last, 30 years of my life, and if today I have another 20, 25, 30 years, I mean, you never know how many you have, but even if you had another 20, imagine what you could do from here, right? And wouldn't that be exciting? Not because you want to win a award or prove anything to anybody, but just because it's so exciting to see how far you can come, right? So I think that has always driven me more than anything else. My wife often keeps asking me that, why are you running around doing all of this stuff, and do you really need to do it? And sometimes she often asks, couldn't you have just been a partner and director at McKinsey like your friends?
Right.
And there is nothing wrong with either of those options.
Right.
But to your question, I think what's driving me is just this excitement of seeing how far you can actually come and what therefore could be possible.
Very interesting.
Which you don't know.
And also going back to one of the earlier things you mentioned, Pramath, authenticity. Somewhere I do think knowing where you came from and sort of ensuring that you're grounded somewhere, I think also I feel that somewhere feels a little more authentic and real when people show up that way.
Yeah, and I think you picked up on a very important point, which is actually the closing point I wanted to make on that point, that I think that authenticity allows you to build collaborations in a way that you otherwise wouldn't be able to build, because it naturally allows people to trust you.
Right.
It enables a huge amount of trust from young to old to senior to junior to people who are meeting you for the first time. And I think I'm good about using that to my advantage, honestly. And of course, not part of that authenticity is to not just use it for your own personal advantage.
But paradox right there, right?
Right. Yeah. So I think that authenticity engenders trust.
Right.
And then if you use that trust to do bigger and greater things,
right,
that is what allows you to take things forward. So yeah. I think that was the essence of my point about going back to where you came from.
Got it.
Because that ultimately connects back to seemingly contradictory, but you start very modest. But then remaining modest allows you to do very immodest things, right?
Very interesting.
Which I think has been the biggest learning I've had in this journey.
And just in conclusion, Pramath, I believe as leaders go through their journey of life, the two questions they grapple with at different points in time are where to go and how to grow. And this podcast is titled Play to Potential. Any summary themes net you want to leave the listeners with for people to play to their potential?
Well, I have a bias to this, and it may not be the be all and end all, but because you are talking about playing to potential, I think there's something to be said about being very authentic about helping other people achieve their true potential. These are things that have been said a lot, you know. The U.S. Army has this thing about come be the best you can be and so on. But I think if there's one thing you as a leader could focus on, or you as an individual could focus on in making other people successful, then in the process of doing that, a lot of benefits that flow out of that actually make you successful. It makes you understand yourself better. It makes you figure out your purpose better. It doesn't seem connected because it's like, oh, I'm making somebody else successful. But that notion in itself is so powerful that it teaches a lot about yourself, what you are, what you want to do, what you should do, and so on. So if there was one thing that I've always sort of felt people didn't value as much is they are so focused on themselves that again it's one of those seeming contradictions that if you actually focus on other people you actually end up focusing on yourself. And I don't mean this to be a very deep point. I actually mean it as simply as that, that if you can just turn your focus on making others successful, then there's huge clarity that comes. Otherwise, you have to worry about 50 things, right? And which of these 50 will really lead me? So one liberating thought is, hey, don't worry about yourself. Just focus on making other people successful. And through that, a lot of those things that you were supposed to do or the 49 other things that you were supposed to do will get done.
Got it.
So that's the one thing that I think in summary would be the big thing that I usually like to impress upon people in different ways.
Lovely, but it's been a real delight talking to you, Pramath. Thank you so much for making the time.
No, thank you. Thank you. You made me really think hard with all these questions.
Really enjoyed the chat. Thank you.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed the podcast conversation. If you found it purposeful, please take a moment to review it on iTunes and share it with people who you think might benefit from this. You can find other conversations at playtopotential.com. But if you want to download the content and listen in an offline mode, let's say during a flight, you could access the content on iTunes, Stitcher, or any of the other popular podcast apps. Just search for Play to Potential when you go to that app. Thank you for listening, and look forward to having you listen into one of the subsequent conversations of the podcast. Bye now.